You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why do songbirds sing? A Wisconsin researcher tells us what's going on in birds' brains when they drop some dope melodies. Now, President Trump tweeted yesterday that he was shutting down negotiations on a new economic relief package that the White House and Congress had been working on for the last couple of months, saying he won't sign any multi-trillion dollar legislation until after the election. That announcement made the stock market drop several hundred points almost immediately. Trump later said that he's open to signing more narrowly focused bills for things like direct checks of $1,200 to many Americans, paycheck protection money for small businesses, and support for the airline industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to President Trump shutting down the prospect of another big economic relief package? Do you think Congress should pass narrower bills focused on, say, restaurants and bars and tourism, the airline industry, direct checks to people unemployed? How is your personal economy doing in this year of the COVID-19 pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and Department of Economics. He's co-author of the book Lost Decades, The Making of America's Debt Crisis and the Long Recovery. Menzie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, before we dig into what's going on in Congress and the White House when it comes to the economy, what is your current read on how the economy is doing, what, 6-7 months into this pandemic?
Well, I think most of the macroeconomists would agree that it's been a remarkable and unique experience in that we've had an unprecedented drop in output. The growth rate was something on the order of negative 30% annualized in the second quarter. And now we're experiencing an incredibly rapid increase, possibly in the order of 30% quarter that's just finished. And now, you have to be careful with percentages. So this will not take us back to where we were at the end of last year. Even with the most optimistic readings, we're probably going to be about 5% down on the year relative to last year. And so the one thing we can say is in this fourth quarter, which we've just entered, everybody was predicting that we would have remarkably slow growth, relatively speaking, that the recovery would slow down a lot. And the fact that we have such uncertainty with respect to policy going forward only makes this time period more critical.
I've seen some research suggesting that the real bad news is kind of hidden under the big numbers, that the impacts of this recession caused by COVID-19 were not evenly distributed. It hit people at the bottom of the ladder especially hard, and they're the slowest to bounce back here. Is that what you're seeing too?
Yes, I think that's pretty much the situation. I want to tell people that in some ways we've experienced the best of times. It's hard to believe, but the best of times in this crisis, because both the Federal Reserve and the federal government stepped in quickly and with massive support, trillions of dollars very quickly to support the economy through the summer. And so that's what's cushioned both households, both, medium income and low income, somewhat. But a lot of those things are petering out. The Paycheck Protection Program, the enhanced unemployment benefits have all ended. And so we are entering this period where it's going to be a lot worse for a lot of people, and the hits will be particularly pronounced on those at the lower income end. That's exactly correct.
Talking to economist Menzie Chin from UW-Madison, looking at the nationwide economy during the COVID-19 pandemic and prospects for and the possible need for more relief efforts from the federal government. Yesterday, a Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said, hey, go big, err on the side of going too big with more stimulus, saying not providing any new relief could have tragic consequences. What did you make of what the Federal Reserve Chair had to say?
Well, that made perfect sense, and it's pretty much in line with what he said in the past, except perhaps a little bit more forcefully. The fact of the matter is, with Federal Reserve's pushing of the Fed funds rate to essentially zero and going full tilt on bond buying bonds of the federal government, there's not a lot more that the Federal Reserve can do. You've seen some of the stimulus already show up from the monetary policy in asset prices, both the stock market and the housing market. But, they've shot their bullet there. And now it's pretty much up to fiscal policy to make sure that the recession doesn't become extended, or that we relapse into another recession or downturn, pretty much fiscal policy is the only game in town. And that's why he argued for greater fiscal stimulus.
Now, the CARES Act came quickly. It was pretty big. Some people said, you know, why did so many people get those economic stimulus checks? Why did the big businesses get so much money? Is it possible to have, now that we've had some time behind us, a more crafted stimulus where we use that money, whatever amount we end up talking about, more efficiently to help the people and small businesses, say, who need it the most?
I think it's possible. I mean, it's possible to break into two parts the sort of issues that have come up so far. One is, you know, did you allocate the funds appropriately? And then there's the other of implementation. Did some people get the money that they shouldn't have got the money? Let me leave those aside. Given how fast this was all done, it was pretty amazing that it was done as well as it was. Going forward, I think we should look closely at which sectors really need support. And in addition, you know, what policies will mitigate the continuation or the growth of the infection rates. So, you know, people, macroeconomists have been saying for a long time, you know, you can't solve completely the economic problem without solving the public health problem. And so whatever we do, we want to make sure that, you know, we're not encouraging people to make the transmission of the disease more rapid. So, for instance, we probably want to support the restaurant sector, but we might not want to encourage them to open up. Maybe we just want to support them so they don't feel the need to open up, because we know that indoor dining, bars, and so forth are a key means by which you enhance the pandemic. So that's one area in which we can think about things. The other one would be to say, yes, which sectors are hurting very much and are unlikely to be able to weather things on their own, and low-income households, but also states and localities, those governments are going to be incredibly cash-strapped going forward as tax revenues remain depressed. And that's one sticking point between the administration and the House Democrats. It's the amount that's going to be transferred to the states. And what we do know is from the last big recession, the recession that ended in June of 2009, is that the fact that the states and localities couldn't spend a lot is something that made the recovery much more slow and prolonged than it otherwise would be.
We're talking to Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at the latest on COVID-19 relief from the federal government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the coronavirus-related recession affected you and your family? Do you want to see more federal relief? If so, for who? For what kind of businesses? For what people? For unemployed people, for example? Do you need some help in your personal finances or in your business, whether you own it or work for it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, talking about the latest news on economic relief after President Trump says he won't sign a new coronavirus relief package, instead later calling for Congress to pass smaller bills. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Eli is with us in La Crosse. Eli, hello.
Hi. I just want to say that I'm happy that he's not going to go sign another big stimulus bill, because we already doubled our normal debt load for this year alone, and certain people within the political workings want to now triple that. We're already extended $1 trillion in debt. How do we expect to pay for all of this?
Eli, thanks a lot for the call. Worries, Menzie, about how much this is costing us, how much is building up our debt?
You know, this is, we spent trillions of dollars already. I would say that back in 2018, when the economy was booming, we essentially gave a tax cut of several trillion dollars on net to people who primarily didn't need it. So, you know, I'm a little wondering about the worries about debt accumulation. Now, the thing is, we could say, well, let's ratchet back on spending now. But what's going to happen is that you're going to have a lot more people being unemployed, dropping out of the labor force. You'll have a lot more firms that go out of business. That process is just starting now, given that the Paycheck Protection Program and other grants like that have expired. And so these are things that are going to have a negative impact on our ability to pay in the future. If we can avoid those things, then we'd be able to sustain a greater amount of debt. I mean, remember, this package that's being debated here is, in some sense, you know, it's between $1.6 trillion from the administration to $2.2 trillion, where it's cut down from $3.4 that the Democrats originally passed in their HEROES Act back in the spring. You know, you have to say you don't want to cut back on support too early. We saw what happened when you did that back in 2009, 2010. You had a very slow recovery and you had a lot of people drop out of the labor force for long stretches of time. You're wasting a lot of human capital at that point. So I would say these are things that you do want to invest in. And if you spend on things that we desperately need, like infrastructure, it won't pay for itself, but it might almost come close. Final point, interest rates in inflation-adjusted terms are close to, if not zero, for the federal government. So you got to ask yourself, do I want to risk the long-term harm that comes from extending this downturn, which is the biggest we've ever seen so far? Or do you want to risk a little bit of extra debt when the cost of financing that debt for the federal government is essentially zero?
Eli, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Martina now in Kashina. Martina, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had followed the first CARES Act bill, and I remember that Mitch McConnell was talking about taking away the ability for workers to sue their employer if they get sick. And I don't remember, I kind of stopped following it after that. And I don't remember, do you know if that was included in the CARES Act or is that being talked about again? And also, are these bills able to override regular OSHA regulations? I mean, these workers are being exposed and getting sick. We all know that. And they're just supposed to, you know, oh, well, too bad to hear some Tylenol. I mean,
Martina, thanks a lot for calling in. Menzie, she's concerned about worker safety and how these relief packages affect it.
Well, I think that's a real concern. To my knowledge, which is probably not complete, it's true that the Republicans wanted liability insurance in the sense that they didn't want to have companies be able to be sued. I don't know what the resolution of that debate was, but I don't recall it being put into the original CARES Act. And I think that might be a sticking point going forward. It has been a sticking point.
I believe that's correct, yes.
And it's very hard to figure out, you know, exactly what's in whatever bill that they're considering, given that minute by minute, the administration's position changes on what they're willing to sign on or not sign on to. But it's true that so far, the failure to enforce the health and safety regulations is essentially by diktat. That is, the federal government has just, through the executive branch, has just refused to enforce those actions. I don't think in practice, what happened was legislation was passed. It's just the federal government went ahead and overturned those regulations in the short term.
Thanks for calling in, Martina. Menzie, we're talking about different things that Congress or the president might or might not do and how money could be best spent. But looking at the political side of things, do you expect anything to happen?
Ah, well, this is a little bit outside of my area of expertise. I mean, I can say for certain that Wall Street economists who are paid money to make assessments have gotten more and more pessimistic about whether there'll be ability to come through with something. The president has recently, by recently, I mean today, has suggested piecemeal approach, which is to say, okay, let's bail out the airlines. Let's give a little bit more Paycheck Protection Program out there, you know, so sort of independent packages. Whether the Democrats would go along with that is another matter, because for them, of course, that'd be giving up the leverage that they would want, for instance, to make sure that the states and localities have additional funding. I mean, it's important to say, you know, the gap that's expected for the states is something like $550 billion in terms of their budgets over the next couple of years. Maybe a little bit less than that now. Things have turned out a little bit better than expected. But, you know, states and localities face this constraint. They can't typically borrow to cover overspending or spending in excess of their revenues. And so they're going to be forced to cut back like they did in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And so the Democrats have wanted more funds than the Republicans have been willing to put forward. And so given that these are different incentives for different groups, and on top of it, it's not clear to me that the Republicans are united between factions of the Senate Republicans and the administration. It's looking grim for a deal before the election. But of course, these are special times, and who knows what could come out at the last minute.
And briefly, in our last minute, Menzie, what are you watching for next?
Well, I am watching for what happens in terms of some sort of relief. I mean, I think we are in a particularly precarious point in this recovery. And without more support, it could be the case that we go to zero growth in the fourth quarter, possibly a relapse in going into the new year, exactly because we have a whole bunch of other effects going on, a whole bunch of other forces, including perhaps the resurgence of the pandemic in the cold months. Put that together with faltering consumer spending because no more transfers, and the states being forced to tighten their belts. And I think we want to be very careful about how we proceed on fiscal policy going forward.
Menzie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you. Pleasure to be.
Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He joined us for a look at the nation's economic outlook and the prospects for different kinds of federal stimulus. After nearly a decade of state-mandated tuition freezes, the University of Wisconsin system has the lowest level of leftover tuition revenues since 2008. Rich Kramer reports that that comes at a time when state universities are facing unprecedented financial losses because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
UW Stout Faculty Senate Chair Glenda Jones says she knew her campus was facing financial problems from declining enrollment even before the coronavirus pandemic forced its closure this spring. What she didn't know is that UW Stout was about to post a negative tuition reserve balance in June.
This summer, myself, I was just thinking, like, are we going to make it through this, you know, or is the state legislature going to come and lock the doors?
Just 2 years before, UW Stout had more than $8 million in tuition reserves for managing declines and unexpected costs.
You know, I just really didn't know how bad things were going to get, and I did feel some resentment about not having those reserves.
University systems in places like California and Tennessee recommend 3 months of reserves to address unexpected costs or enrollment declines. But in 2013, Republican lawmakers were outraged to learn the UW system had nearly $650 million in reserves. The money came mostly from tuition, which had gone up by around 5% for 5 years in a row. So the legislature froze tuition, cut more than $250 million in state support, and told campuses to spend down their reserves. A WPR review of campus reserve funds found only one school had 3 months of operating expenses on hand. That can leave regional campuses like UW-Stout in a tough position. This fall, enrollment is down again, this time by about 5%. That means around $2 million less in tuition revenue than expected. The campus has a plan to rebuild its tuition balance through employee furloughs, early retirement buyouts, and a potential restructuring of its colleges. UW Oshkosh and UW Stevens Point are working through similar plans. Stevens Point has nearly doubled its tuition balances by cutting nearly 60 staff positions and combining some degree programs. Greg Summers is the campus provost.
We also stabilized our enrollment and have even grown in some areas, especially in graduate programs. and that's helped contribute to the increased tuition balance. But the pandemic came along last spring, and it's kind of moved the goal line for us.
With tuition frozen at 2013 levels, he says they need more state support to stay in the black.
Otherwise, institutions like ours get squeezed. And that's just a math problem. It's not a political statement. It's just mathematics.
Republican State Representative Dave Murphy chairs the Assembly Committee on Colleges and Universities and thinks spending down reserve funds was the right thing to do.
Having some mechanisms in place that allow us to keep them at small levels and still feel comfortable that we're not putting the institution in any kind of a bad economic place. I think that's a reasonable way to handle our situations on campus.
Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland also serves on the Colleges and Universities Committee. She says current financial problems at UW campuses navigating impacts from COVID-19 are the result of a created crisis.
My colleagues, the Republicans who forced UW system institutions to spend down their cash reserves, would say they need to be run like a business, but it's a common business practice to keep cash reserves on hand for financial emergencies like this one.
UW System Board of Regents President Drew Peterson says the board has spent years improving transparency about balances and is pleased campuses have reduced them as lawmakers required, but he recognizes something needs to change.
I think the tuition freeze puts campuses at a very challenged level just simply because that's your operating revenue and it doesn't change year over year.
But the pandemic is hitting Wisconsin families and state revenues hard. A push to raise tuition or find another way to give campuses a bigger financial cushion isn't likely. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, Governor Evers has issued a new order restricting the size of indoor gatherings. WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson gives us the details. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, 1A Plus checks in with listeners around the country to find out how the COVID-19 pandemic has shaped their lives this year. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, new research from UW-Madison shows that songbirds sing because it's a rewarding social activity. The study, published in the journal Scientific Reports, found that singing does good stuff for a songbird's brain, and there could be a lesson here for us humans. Lauren Readers is a professor of integrative biology at the UW-Madison. She recently led the study on the rewards of birdsong. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
We'll start us off with the focus of your study. What were you trying to figure out here?
Well, so for my lab, we're really interested in the role that reward plays in shaping communication, and we study this in songbirds. So male songbirds, I mean, people know this. They're famous for singing to attract mates and to defend territories, but we were really intrigued by the fact that birds sing in other contexts as well. So we study starlings, which I know ornithologists will groan because they're considered pest species. They kick out bluebirds, but they're amazing singers. And both male and female starlings, they sing in large flocks outside the breeding season. They're doing this right now, but it's not obvious why they're doing it. They sing, they don't attract a mate, they don't repel a competitor. So we became intrigued by the possibility that perhaps they're singing because it's rewarding. I mean, we know it's important for learning. They have to learn and practice songs in order to sing species typical song. But in immediate sense, it wasn't clear why they were doing that. So this is why we decided to investigate the possibility that perhaps they're singing because it's intrinsically rewarding.
Well, before we get into the songbird's brain, let's get our brains on the right track with a listen to some of a call from a European starling. Here it is. All right, well, it sounds like they're having fun there. What did you find out is going on in the brains of starlings when they're doing this, what appears to be, it sounds like, non-essential singing?
Yeah, I mean, First of all, if you hear the songbirds singing in spring, when they're trying to attract a mate, we find that it's really stereotyped. But outside the breeding season, when we know that it's important time for them to practice song, we actually think they might be playing around with the song. So, you know, if you ask, why do puppies play? Why do humans play? It's developmentally important, and they do it because it's rewarding. And so we thought maybe it's very similar to what we see with birdsong. They're singing, they're practicing, and so perhaps it's rewarding. And so we found that this kind of song is really sloppy. We've thought of it sort of as maybe a form of freeform jazz that we're hearing. Yeah.
I like it. So what is the reward here? Obviously, it's not a mate because it's the off season and it's a different kind of song. What is going on in the songbird, the starling's brain that rewards them for this improvisational singing?
Yeah, so that's what we were curious about. And it's, I already mentioned social play behavior. It is well known that play behavior releases endogenous opioids. So opioids across the animal kingdom are involved in natural reward. So opioids like heroin, morphine, and fentanyl, they're famous right now because of the opioid epidemic, but they're also well known for inducing both pleasure and reducing pain. And so birds, as well as humans, we produce our own endogenous opioids. And so we thought perhaps it's the birds' endogenous opioids that are regulating this specific type of singing behavior.
And is it?
Well, we think so. I mean, first we had to figure out how do you ask a bird if it feels good
right
to sing? So what we did there is we use what's called a condition place preference test. It's commonly used in psychology to test reward. So we had birds singing in these flocks outside the breeding context. And then you just take a bird and you put it immediately in a distinct environment. So, for example, a blue cage. And then the next day we would give birds a choice between a blue cage or a red cage. And we found that if birds sang high rates of this song in flocks, they developed a very strong preference for a blue cage. So this suggests that the bird is associating this place with singing in a positive way. Kind of like if you're like me, you might find yourself in the kitchen, right? You associate the kitchen right now during the pandemic with tasty treats. So you return there, right? So we kind of took advantage of this condition place preference to provide insight into how a bird is feeling when it's singing.
Talking to Lauren Readers, professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison, trying to answer questions about why songbirds sing. What's in it for them? What do they get out of it? Now, from what you're saying, Lauren, I could see a couple different things here. Maybe there's an evolution that says, hey, when you sing, we trigger this endogenous opioid, this built-in good feeling all by
right
yourself. Or you've also mentioned singing in flocks. Is it that they're, you know, in a social setting, they're socializing with each other, and then they get that boost? Could it be either, both? I don't know.
Actually, we do think it's probably both. We have given starlings low doses of fentanyl, just a transient increase in, so fentanyl is the drug that it binds to these opioid receptors that can stimulate reward, and we find that they sing at really high rates. And then we've also disrupted those opioid receptors, and we find that that breaks the link between singing and reward. So they no longer show a place preference associated with song, and they sing less. And so our interpretation is that it could be that joining the flock leads to opioid release that's rewarding and that triggers the singing behavior. And then perhaps the act of singing itself is leading to further opioid release to further reinforce that singing behavior.
All right. Now, here's a question, maybe a stupid question. Are these songbirds, are these starlings having fun when they sing? If we can interpret the human concept of fun and apply it to a bird?
That's right. So there are very few behaviors that animals do for no apparent reason, right? Usually there's some immediate outcome. But these birds are just singing. And if you watch them, it looks they're doing it right now. You could see them outside. It looks like they're singing into space. And so the notable exception to that is play behavior, which is why we started to ask, could this be a form of playful behavior? Play behavior, you do it for no reason. It's important, you know, in the long run, developmentally. And so even Darwin proposed that perhaps birds in this context were singing for their own amusement. And I would say that, yeah, our data are suggesting, you know, they're singing this freeform jazz. It's a playful behavior.
Now, maybe I'm mammal-centric here. I usually associate this kind of fun, playful behavior with what I think of, maybe unfairly, as more complex organisms like mammals. Am I underestimating birds? Does the bird brain stereotype underestimate what they can do?
Yeah, that's right. There is this bird brain stereotype. And I think part of that is because if you look at the bird's brain, it looks smooth and mammal brains are really wrinkly. And so people thought, well, birds, you know, their brain is devoted to flying. And so, you know, they've got this simple brain that lets them do primitive behaviors. But people studying birds are finding actually they're capable of extremely complicated behaviors, and that their brain, it's organized differently from mammals, but there are a lot of similarities. So actually, I mean, this brings me to the idea that I think that what we're studying birds may actually apply to mammals. Perhaps it may even provide insights into human behavior.
How so?
Well, birds and mammals, they had a common ancestor over 300 million years ago. And so it is possible, right, that what we're looking at is a bird thing. But we think it's unlikely because neurochemicals, like the opioids that we look at, and neural systems that regulate social behaviors and reward seem to have been conserved in evolution. So they've been retained, and they're very similar across vertebrates, which suggests that by studying rewarding birdsong, we can understand how the brain makes social behaviors positive and rewarding, including in humans, right? So if you look at humans with depression, social interactions, playful, positive interactions are no longer rewarding, the kind of interactions we're looking at in starlings. If you look at social anxiety, these kind of interactions are interactions that humans wish to avoid. So we think that by studying the social behavior in songbirds, we can develop new ideas for treatments that might promote positive interactions in humans that might be socially withdrawn or no longer find human contact to be rewarding.
We'll leave it there. Lauren, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Lauren Readers is a professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. She talked to us about a study she authored on the chemical rewards of singing for birds. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. The International Crane Foundation, based in Baraboo, works around the world to save cranes. In a story from our archives, producer Brianne Chasseau spent a day at its headquarters learning about its conservation work with whooping cranes.
How long ago did the chick hatch?
20 minutes, maybe. 15 minutes?
It's just out.
We asked this chick not to hatch until this morning so that you can see it.
That's Bryant Tarr, curator of birds for the International Crane Foundation.
So this bird has been in the other room for 2 days now when it started peeping. Then it pipped, which is it makes that first little hole in the shell. And then it rests for about 24 hours. And then the next day it just saws its way around and pops out. And that's what just happened.
We're silent in the room where the chick is kept. Tarr lets me peek in the incubator at the chick after turning out the light so he, or she, can't see me. The chick, who has a June birthday, is damp, brown, and maybe a little bigger than a tennis ball, showing no signs, yet, of the snowy plumage it'll one day have. The chick will later be named Phantom, following this year's theme of naming the whooping crane chicks after Wisconsin lakes. She is part of the foundation's direct autumn release program, which began in 2005. Phantom will spend the next few months learning how to be a crane from scientists wearing crane suits. Costume rearing helps the chicks avoid imprinting on humans, and is something the foundation began experimenting with in the 1980s.
My name is Marianne Wellington, and I am a lead aviculturist and a chick rearing supervisor.
Wellington's work includes spending the coming months, along with others, wearing white costumes mimicking whooping cranes and carrying MP3 players that play sounds a parent crane would make for the chicks. The costumes cover people from head to toe and include a puppet worn on one of the person's hands that resembles a crane's head. There's absolutely no talking.
I learned a lot from other species on what I should or shouldn't do in costume, or what I can and can't do in costume. When you're wearing a costume, your puppet is on your hand, and so you need to think about the fact that your hand acts like a head, and so your hand has to be looking at different things. So when an airplane goes over, you cock your head a little bit so that one eye is looking up at the airplane or at the hawk flying over. But if it's a hawk or something they're not sure about, they'll start watching longer and longer, and you're like, oh, what is that? And so you just need to learn to freeze. And so for me, it is more of a, if I think about it correctly, it's more of a zen interaction, trying to be a crane as much as I can.
In the fall, the whooping crane chicks are released near older whooping cranes so they can learn the migration route south.
It's a time of lots of emotions. So you're sad because you're letting these animals that you were working with so much, you get attached to them. It's hard not to. You get attached to them, so it's sad to see them go. But there's this fantastic feeling to see them fly. And I see them fly anyway. From day to day, taking them out, they fly, and it's amazing that they come back. It's just amazing. But to see them fly and be cranes in the wild, it's just fantastic.
In early November, 8 whooping crane chicks were released. 2 other chicks, one of which is Phantom, were kept because of their good genetics.
Brianne Shasso reporting there. We're sorry to share the news that Brianne passed away this week at the age of 31 after being diagnosed with cancer. All of us here at Wisconsin Public Radio send our thoughts to her family and the many friends and colleagues who are mourning her loss and sharing their memories as we speak. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers announced a new executive order yesterday aimed at slowing the spread of COVID-19 in the state. It's set to go into effect at 8 a.m. tomorrow and intended to be in place until November 6th. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
All right. What is in this new executive order, Sean?
So this new executive order is really specific to crowd sizes at indoor locations. And when I say really specific, I mean, there's a lot of indoor locations that are exempt. You know, so for example, it doesn't cover grocery stores, or it doesn't cover construction businesses or manufacturing plants or warehouses. It's more geared at places where the public could gather, like a restaurant or a bar. In fact, those are kind of the main places that are covered by this order. And so what it says is that a private venue would be limited to 25% of its usual capacity. So if you're a restaurant with a capacity of 200 people indoors, you'd be limited to a capacity of 50 under the governor's order.
Did the governor talk about why he was specifying these particular kinds of businesses?
His administration talked about how they are places where COVID-19 has spread. And I mean, as you've seen scientists talk about the COVID-19 pandemic, they have talked about these indoor closed locations where people are in close proximity. You don't have the circulation that you do outdoors, that those are kind of the danger spots. And so that is why the Evers administration focused its order on those spots in this order.
Now, it's been a long 6-7 months already since we've been dealing with the coronavirus and COVID-19. I want to listen to Governor Evers talking about that concern about, I think, COVID fatigue. Here's a listen.
Trust me, folks. I know we are all tired. We are all frustrated, and we just want to get back to our Wisconsin way of life. You and me both. But at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, we have to change the course of this virus, and that's going to take a united effort.
And talk, Sean, about the course of this virus and what we're seeing in Wisconsin over this last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's the numbers are just horrible now compared to what they were, you know, this spring when we had much more, aggressive measures in place to keep people distant, when a number of businesses were closed at the time. If you look at our hospitalization statistics in Wisconsin, there's this graph that's on the Wisconsin Hospital Association, and it just keeps climbing basically to the sky. You know, it's every day there's a new record. The number of patients who are in the hospital for COVID-19 and in the ICU for COVID-19 just keep going up. You know, the state's now working to set up a field hospital in the Milwaukee area to deal with potential overflow. And you've got hospital systems saying that they are pretty much stressed to the max right now. I mean, the governor used the word teetering to describe the healthcare system. So, the numbers we're seeing right now are a lot worse than they were back in, March and April, when people were generally more freaked out about the pandemic.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with the latest on new emergency orders from Governor Evers. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican, had a response he issued today. What did he have to say?
So Voss said that I guess a couple of things. One, he asked for a meeting with the governor. Two, he said that if the order that was issued yesterday were challenged in court, that a Wisconsin judge would find the order invalid. He also asked Evers Department of Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm to submit an emergency rule to the legislature's Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules, which is the process that the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that future orders should go through if they're like Safer at Home. But in this case, what the Evers administration is saying is that they have kind of threaded the needle, in terms of issuing this order in a way that they think is legal. Because what the Supreme Court did this May, when it struck down Safer at Home, it preserved the power of governors, the governor's administration to restrict gatherings. There was a very specific piece of that order that the court just said it was leaving intact. And so that is what the Evers administration says it's relying on here. And so they think it's legal. And, even if there's dispute over that, the court has changed since the last time this was before the court, So there's a chance that the Evers administration would like its chances better if it were to be appealed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court again.
I don't think it's an understatement, Sean, to say that the governor's office and his administration and Republican leadership in the legislature have not worked together very closely since the passage of a big bill in April to do some of the basics here. Can you describe the state of cooperation or not between those two groups?
Yeah, I guess just imagine the least cooperative groups you can imagine. And that's kind of what we have in Wisconsin, the governor has issued these recent orders on his own. We're talking about this one for gatherings here, which he issued through his Department of Health Services using one law. He issued his mask mandate, which Republicans are challenging, using another law that gives governors the power to issue, public health emergencies. Republicans are challenging that. But in both cases, he said he issued them because he couldn't get any cooperation from the legislature. And, the legislature is challenging him in court and kind of calling him out on this latest one. So there is no cooperation, is I guess what you would say about state government in Wisconsin in this trying time.
So what are you watching for next, Sean, when it comes to state efforts to slow the spread of COVID?
Well, I mean, as this gets worse, I guess it's an open question. The governor trying to restrict gatherings here was a step that he wasn't willing to take a week ago. And if things get better, maybe there will be fewer restrictive measures. If they get worse, who knows? And if a court steps in and says that a governor can't do some of these things, that will influence things too. If he has to go through the legislature to issue future rules, there are going to be lawmakers there who feel like the state needs to be less restrictive when it comes to dealing with this pandemic and not more restrictive.
I know briefly as we wrap up, Sean, I know a judge in one of the cases questioned why Republicans or why the legislature didn't come into session and override the governor's emergency orders if they didn't like them. Is there talk of doing that among lawmakers?
There is talk about doing that among rank and file Republican lawmakers who very much want to come in and take that vote. And because the law that the governor used to issue that mask mandate, there is a provision in there that says legislature can just take a simple majority vote and strike it down. Legislative leaders have not done that. And so the judge was asking, why should I do it if the legislature won't do it? You've got some rank and file Republicans asking the same things, but GOP leaders do not want to take that vote.
Sean, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with the latest on new emergency orders from Governor Evers. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, pollster Charles Franklin joins the show to break down the latest numbers in the race for president here in Wisconsin. Survey looks at attitudes toward things like mask mandates and other COVID-related efforts as well. Find out the results and how they fit in. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we preview tonight's vice presidential debate and our look at some of the week's top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.